When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Where Were You in 92 is a production of iHeartRadio.
They want you to do something different. They want to shock people. They want you to kind of like almost destroy their own myth. And that's where it went to the dark side, really.
Welcome to Where Were You in 92, a podcast in which I, your host, Jason Lanfier, look back at the major hits, one-hit wonders, shocking news stories, and irresistible scandals that shaped what might be the wildest, most eclectic, most controversial 12 months of music ever. This week, with their brazen sampling, outrageous PR stunts, and bizarro performances, pop house anarchists the KLF set out to blow up the music industry, pairing electric guitars with dance beats, rapping with new age lyricism, and the nightlife with the contemporary art world. The mysterious UK duo of Bill Drummond and Jimmy Cauty were all about breaking rules and defying expectations. They reached their crazy sonic peak when their left field 1992 collaboration with country icon Tammy Wynette became an unlikely global smash, hitting number one in 18 countries. The response to their newfound fame? Just as fervent fans and bewildered journalists felt like they were arriving at the fictitious Moomoo Land at the center of the song, the group abandoned music altogether and vanished, taking their catalog with them. In this episode, we explore the KLF's wild ride to stardom, from their doomed road trip to meet ABBA, to their infamous performance in which one of them took a machine gun and fired blanks into the audience, to their mind-boggling decision to film themselves burning their earnings, a staggering £1 million. The year was 1987. Scotsman Bill Drummond had been toiling away in the music industry for several years and now found himself disillusioned. In the late 1970s, he'd formed the Liverpool punk group Big in Japan. His bandmates included Holly Johnson, who'd go on to score an 80s hit called Relax with his group Frankie Goes to Hollywood, and Budgie, who'd eventually become part of Susie and the Banshees. After Big in Japan broke up, Drummond and another member, David Balfe, founded Zoo Records, which released early work from Echo and the Bunnymen, whose debut album, Crocodiles, they produced. In the 1980s, Drummond had taken a job as an A&R guy for the record label Warner Elektra Atlantic, working out of its London office and pouring a ton of time and energy into promoting the rock act Brilliant. But the band never really took off, and by the age of 33, Drummond was jaded with the corporate side of the music industry. He wanted to be an artist, so in 1986, he resigned from his position, issuing a fake press release. Soon after, he put out his solo album, The Man, a well-received blend of American country and Scottish folk. Drummond loved music, in particular the mystery that surrounded it. What do the songs mean? How were they made? What were the artists behind them really like? But he'd found himself bored with the pop music dominating the charts. it had become so formulaic. While out walking on January 1st, 1987, he decided the way forward was hip-hop. That's where innovation was thriving, he thought. Trouble was, Drummond didn't know how the hell to make a hip-hop record. He'd need to sample other songs, but he didn't have a sampler. He knew someone who did, though. Jimmy Cauty, a member of Brilliant, the group he'd signed and promoted as an A&R guy. Brilliant had disbanded, and Cauty was not only free to explore his next venture, but instantly intrigued by the idea of trying his hand at hip-hop. By March of 1987, the pair were sending out 45s of their first track to DJs and music journalists under the alias The Justified Ancients of Moo Moo, a.k.a. The Jams. The name was inspired by Robert Shea and Robert Anton Wilson's The Illuminatus book trilogy, a sci-fi satire peppered with sex, drugs, and conspiracy theories that Drummond and Cauty would source for ideas throughout their career. The Jams' debut song, All You Need Is Love, sampled not only the Beatles song of the same name, but also MC5's Kick Out the Jams, British pin-up pop vixen Samantha Fox's Touch Me, and the voice of John Hurt from the British PSA Don't Die of Ignorance about the impact and dangers of AIDS. Over beatbox rhythms, Drummond, in his heavy Scottish accent, rapped, "With this killer virus, who needs war? I said shag, shag, shag some more." The cut also included snippets of erotic panting and the nursery rhyme Ring Around the Rosie, which some have speculated was about the bubonic plague in Europe. So yeah, this was a far cry from, say, Beastie Boys' Fight for Your Right. Michelangelo Matos is a music journalist, critic, and author of The Underground is Massive, How Electronic Dance Music Conquered America. He describes the Jams' late 80s work as a type of punk, playful, tongue-in-cheek approach to sampling. Not just more expansive, but also intentionally messy and silly.
There were all these DJ records. There was this big efflorescence of James Brown sampling hip-hop tracks. And in dance music, that sound became, you know, instrumental versions of those sorts of things, cut-ups, that those became very popular in clubs at that point. And so the KLF was like a piss take of that, basically. They were basically taking that idea and just throwing it in a blender. You know, you think you know what sampling can be? Here's what sampling can be. We're going to just sample every damn thing we want.
Drummond and Cauty hadn't gotten permission to use any of the samples. But as Ian Shirley writes in his book, Turn Up the Strobe, The KLF, The Jams, The Time Lords, A History, Drummond rejected claims that this was theft. As he explained in an interview with the music paper Sounds, quote, "It's like saying Andy Warhol just stole other people's graphics, which he didn't. He took other people's images and recycled them and reused them. That doesn't mean he's robbed them and left them with nothing. We're just doing musically what he did with the Campbell's soup cans and a picture of Marilyn Monroe." In June 1987, the Justified Ancients of Moo Moo released their debut album, 1987, What the Fuck is Going On? To promote it, Drummond and Cauty climbed onto the roof of the National Theater of the South Bank of the River Thames and painted the name of the record on the building. They got away with it. A fusion of house music and hip-hop, 1987 included myriad samples. The Jams remained unapologetic about incorporating other artists' music without permission. As Drummond told the music paper Record Mirror, quote, "It's like 1955 and you've got yourself an electric guitar and then somebody from the Acoustic Guitar Society comes around and says, 'I'm sorry, you can't do that. It's against the law to use electricity in instruments.' And that's what it feels like. We've got these samplers. How are we meant to use them?" 1987 included samples from major acts like the Monkees, James Brown, Led Zeppelin, Jimi Hendrix, and Stevie Wonder, and even lifted a bit from the Lonely Goat Herd from The Sound of Music for its final track, Next. But it was their egregious sample of a certain beloved Swedish pop group on their song, The Queen and I, that caused the Jams trouble. Says Turn Up the Strobe author Ian Shirley.
They used Whitney Houston. They sampled Whitney Houston. They sampled lots of different artists and different sounds and got into a bit of hot water. Obviously with ABBA, they sampled ABBA and ABBA allegedly sued them.
After meeting with the Mechanical Copyright Protection Society, who were about as fun as they sound, Drummond and Cauty received a letter notifying them that they had violated the Copyright Act of 1957 by not seeking permission to use other musicians' work to produce their own. Not only had they breached copyright, but ABBA was not willing to grant them permission to use their disco classic, Dancing Queen, and demanded that they cease production and distribution of their album, as well as acquire and surrender all copies of it so they could be destroyed. The Swedish Darlings weren't about to take a chance on these crooked pranksters. They'd been slapped with a cease and desist order, and God only knew what the legal and monetary repercussions would be. But the Jams had an idea. Why not take this as an opportunity to use ABBA again to make more art? Their next act of loopy subversion? To trek it to Sweden and ask the group in person for permission to use Dancing Queen. On their song, The Queen and I, Drummond asks, "Have you ever met ABBA? I'd love to meet ABBA." Well, yeah, who wouldn't? But now he and Caudi were actually going to try to make that happen. Their picaresque journey would be one of the first PR stunts of their career. To maximize the exposure, they called on journalist James Brown, not the musician, who was then working at the New Musical Express, and photographer Lawrence Watson to accompany them on their quest. So I'm sure you're already wondering what happened when these thieving rogues showed up at ABBA's doorstep. What did the Swedish superstars say? Well, Drummond and Caudi never made it to ABBA. Instead, Caudi's American police car transporting the band of misfits puttered out, they hit a moose, and they ended up getting chased away by a pissed off farmer with a shotgun after they sent a bunch of copies of their album 1987 on fire on his property. Destroying their music was symbolic, their grandiose way of apologizing to ABBA and ceasing and desisting. But it also made for good copy and imagery for their NME story. They'd also ask Watson to shoot them throwing copies of the album off the ferry into the sea during the adventure. As journalist Brown recalls in Ian Shirley's book, Turn Up the Strobe, when they arrived in Stockholm, they couldn't find ABBA. They didn't even have their address. So at 3 a.m, in another symbolic gesture, they gave a gold record to a local prostitute they encountered on the street. On it, they had written their mea culpa and surrendered to the pop stars. Their message read, "Presented to Benny, Bjorn, and Stig to celebrate sales in excess of 0 copies of the Justified Ancients of Mumu's LP 1987. Like they'd done with the records they'd burned and tossed off the ferry, they asked Watson to snap a pic of the prostitute with her new gift. This whole excursion was basically pointless, but the NME story ran and the Jams came one step closer to cementing their reputation as tricksters. They'd go on to record other singles with blatant samples. Their track Whitney Joins the Jams contains snippets from the Mission Impossible theme, Isaac Hayes' Shaft theme, and Whitney Houston's I Want to Dance with Somebody. Another, Downtown, sampled the 1964 Petula Clark song of the same name. But Drummond and Caudi knew they couldn't continue pilfering other acts' music. Their next PR stunt? To release a new version of 1987 called The Jams 45 Edits. That left out the samples and instead included instructions on the record sleeve for how to create the original album with a 12-inch, a turntable, and the music they'd used. The only way for fans to get this version of the album was if they brought their original copies of 1987 into record shops and surrendered them. In 1988, less than a year after their botched attempt to go meet ABBA, Drummond and Caudi's penchant for sampling transformed them from cult darlings into bona fide chart toppers. Dropping their moniker, The Jams, and rebranding themselves as the Time Lords, the pair released their new single, Doctor in the TARDIS, a novelty track that lifted the theme from the smash UK show Doctor Who and mashed it up with Gary Glitter's 1972 glam rock song, Rock and Roll Part 2, and bits from the glam rock band Sweet's 1973 UK number one, Blockbuster. Doctor in the TARDIS referenced the name of the blue phone booth time machine in Doctor Who. TARDIS is an acronym for time and relative dimension in space. The song wasn't a house record. It skewed closer to spacey stadium rock, something to chant along with at sporting events. Its lyrics simply repeated, Doctor Who, the TARDIS, ad infinitum. That's likely why the song scored Drummond and Caudi their first number one single, despite being widely panned by critics, who called it everything from, quote, excruciating to, quote, rancid. Of course, the Time Lords were in on the joke. They recognized the song's absurdity, but they also understood the kind of tunes that would invigorate the British masses. Doctor and the TARDIS spent a week at the summit of the UK charts, inspiring the Time Lords to publish a book titled The Manual, How to Have a Number One the Easy Way. A case study in the song's success, it offered a step-by-step guide to writing a number one single with no money or musical aptitude. They understood this was a foolish and reductive premise, but like their sample-heavy music, it was more of an ironic art piece, a commentary on the methodic nature of the pop music industry complex and on late 80s capitalism. Drummond explained his reasoning for putting out the book in a 1991 interview. Quote, "It was an excuse to say a lot of things I wanted to say about how the industry worked. It was an excuse to go out and say to people all they can say to themselves. If you want to do something, go and do it. Don't wait to be asked. Don't wait for a record company to come and want to sign you or a management company. Just go and do it. Also, it was saying, if you want to have a number one, you can have it. It won't make you rich. It won't make you happy, but you can have it." Of course, the book was just another chance for the duo to get some media coverage, something they were adept at, says Michelangelo Matos.
They knew the press. They had the press on their sides. There was a certain amount of, let's see what we can get away with because we know exactly how much ink we can generate from this.
The Time Lords' other strategy for building buzz? Using Caudi's old American police car, the one they'd taken to try to meet ABBA, for all the publicity for the single. Naming it Ford Time Lord, they credited the car with writing the song and sent it to all their photo shoots, appearances, and interviews. Someone affiliated with the group would hide in the vehicle under a pile of carpets and field frustrated journalist questions. The single's cover featured an image of it with a speech bubble that read, "Hi, I'm Ford Time Lord. I'm a car, and I've made a record." The Time Lords were short-lived, finished as soon as they'd started. Drummond and Caudi would release a second hip-hop house album as The Jams, but they were growing uncomfortable with their rising popularity and the flack they were getting for all their sampling. Who Killed the Jams marked the end of the Justified Ancients of Mumu and the beginning of the duo's new iteration, the KLF. Little did they know they were about to become the most famous they'd ever be. Up next, after the break, Drummond and Caudi reached their commercial and creative peak, scoring a string of worldwide hits and enlisting an American country legend to craft one of their craziest and most enduring singles yet. Plus, we'll explore the staggering acts of self-sabotage that ended their musical careers.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
My name is Johnny B. Good, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, CentraTech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
I came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Bill Drummond and Jimmy Cauty had spent a year audaciously experimenting with samples to make strange, very Scottish-sounding, and frankly, very awkward hip-hop. They'd hit number one with their Doctor Who sampling novelty song, Doctor in the TARDIS. With their offbeat sound collages and over-the-top publicity stunts, they'd garnered the attention and, for the most part, the respect of the music press. They'd also spent a fair share of their time pulling the music industry's pigtails. Now, casting aside their previous stage names, The Jams and The Time Lords, they were ready to get serious about dance music, specifically house music, and more specifically, acid house. Acid house was a direct descendant of Chicago house and Detroit techno, a mostly underground dance movement that had failed to infiltrate the mainstream. By the late 80s, however, clubs were playing it a lot more, and it eventually became synonymous with UK rave culture. Promoters would throw DJ'd parties in warehouses, fields, and other clandestine places where revelers would dance all through the night and well into the morning. The drug ecstasy was a major player. Under their new name, the KLF, supposedly an acronym for the Copyright Liberation Front, Drummond and Cauty were drawn to Acid House's trademarks: the bass, created by the Roland TB-303 synthesizer, and beats crafted from the Roland TR-808 drum machine. Acid House was dark, stabby, squelchy, and trippy. Their first true crack at an Acid House-influenced track was the instrumental cut What Time Is Love, released in October 1988. The song became popular in clubs across Europe. The KLF would go on to record two more versions of What Time Is Love, adding vocals and fleshing it out more. In July 1990, they released What Time Is Love live at Transcentral. Transcentral was their recording studio. The house pop take on the song catapulted them into the mainstream, peaking at number 5 on the UK charts. By that point, the duo had already released Chill Out, an ambient house concept album meant to chronicle a railroad journey from Texas to Louisiana, though neither Drummond nor Cauty had been to that part of the US. This was simply their impression of what it was like. And press materials included with review copies of the record, they joked, quote, "Ambient house is what the Angels chill out to after the Christmas rush." Sure, they were being their cheeky selves with that description. However, Chill Out proved that the duo were capable of more restrained, well-curated, sophisticated music. Says Matos.
So, basically, Jimmy Cauty is playing as a DJ in the ambient room at Land of Oz, which is Paul Oakenfold's club. They're playing ambient music and found sound recordings, things like Electronic Counterpoint by Steve Reich or whatever. They're playing this stuff in that room.
That stuff would inspire 1990s Chill Out, arguably the KLF's most influential release. Over 45 continuous minutes, steel guitar and samples of Elvis, Fleetwood Mac, and Van Halen rub up against bits of birdsong, crickets, chugging trains, bleating sheep, news reports, and tubin throat singers. Chill Out manages, somehow, to be both barely there and to totally envelop you. It's the sound of waking up the morning or the afternoon after the rave. Nothing like it had ever been put to tape. But the trip depicted on Chill Out was just a detour. The KLF were still enthralled by acid house and techno, and the success of What Time Is Love showed that listeners were too. In March 1991, they released The White Room, the closest rave culture had ever come to top 40 radio. Most of the album's cuts had been recorded in some form in 1989 as the soundtrack for a film of the same name. Featuring scenes shot in the mountainous Sierra Nevada region of Spain, the movie followed them as they searched for the mystical white room that would release them from their contract with Eternity. But it turned out to be just another expensive KLF lark, and it was ultimately scrapped. The album The White Room came on the heels of the act's first number one single as the KLF, 3AM Eternal. It would also become their highest charting U.S. hit, peaking at number 5. 3AM Eternal is the quintessential KLF stadium house track, even including the sound of rapturous stadium applause, though the guys actually recorded it in the studio. Drummond and Caudy extended this vibe to the whole first side of the album, which unfurled like a live concert. With its more polished, accessible sound and soulful diva vocals, 3AM Eternal appealed to both American pop fans and party-hopping lovers of acid house, which had begun to seep into certain dance clubs and underground parties. Says Michelangelo Matos,
91 is when the sort of rave sound emerges from European producers basically copying Underground Resistance, the techno band from Detroit. And then by 92, it's being sold back to America, which is this weird Ouroboros thing where Black American music has been transmogrified by Europeans and sold back to America under the auspices of it being European, which it in some ways is and in many ways is not. A lot of that music was by Black people in Detroit, and American independent labels weren't going to sell that. They weren't going to like put that face on it because they didn't want it. They were trying to sell it to the newly emergent alternative crowd.
The follow-up single to 3AM Eternal, Last Train to Trans Central, didn't chart in the US Hot 100, but it soared to number 2 in the UK in the spring of 1991. It wasn't until late November that year that the KLF would release their next single, Justified and Ancient, Stand By the Jams. But Drummond and Caudy didn't want to just release the album version of Justified and Ancient, a song that actually showed up in its original form on the Jams' debut album, 1987. On The White Room, Justified and Ancient was a piano-led soul track featuring blissed-out vocals from reggae artist and multi-instrumentalist Errol Nicholson, aka Black Steel. But the remix single version would follow in its predecessor's thumping footsteps and keep the rave going, with more beats, more samples, and a very surprising choice for a guest vocalist. Singer Maxine Harvey, who sang on 3AM Eternal, had originally recorded lead vocals for the updated version of Justified and Ancient. But she couldn't take the song's subject matter seriously. Specifically the lines, "They're justified and they're ancient and they drive an ice cream van." As she told Ian Shirley in his book, Turn Up the Strobe, quote, "Even though I was working with different people, I'd always been conscious about lyrics and I weren't singing about ice cream." In his book, 45, Drummond notes, without naming her, that the singer, quote unquote, sounded uninspired, but that Caudy had an epiphany one day, suggesting they enlist none other than country legend Tammy Wynette for the song. A major country fan, Drummond jumped at the idea and claims he was on the phone with Wynette 20 minutes later, playing her the track as she stood backstage at a concert in Tennessee. As the story goes, Drummond flew to Tennessee a week later to meet Tammy Wynette in person. While she was still country royalty and touring, the 49-year-old singer was no longer climbing the charts like she had in her 60s and 70s heyday. If Drummond was stoked to work with a hero, Wynette was enticed by the idea of fronting a dance pop single with some trendy new hitmakers. She, Drummond, and her manager and fifth husband, George Ritchie, went to a local studio where Wynette was set to record her vocals over Drummond's backing track. But there was a snag. You see, Wynette was used to singing with a live backing band who took her lead. This process was foreign to her, and she kept singing too quickly or slowly for the beats. Drummond was pretty mortified, feeling silly for forcing one of his idols to sing about ice cream and being, quote, bound for Moomoo Land. He remembers the recording process as being a complete disaster, with him coming back to the UK worried he had nothing and that he'd have to nix the whole thing. But Caudy had good news. By using some fancy editing program, They could sample Wynette's vocals and sync them up with the music, turning what Drummond thought was a shattered dream collaboration into a sparkling, singular reality. Errol Nicholson lent some backing vocals, and Drummond and Coddy layered in vocals from some Zulu singers. They'd saved the track and soon enjoyed the fruits of their labor. The Ice Cream Van and their retooled version of Justified and Ancient was not only bound for Moomooland, but also for the charts, parking at number 2 on the UK singles charts, number 2 on the US dance charts, and number 1 in several countries, including Austria, Denmark, Finland, and Sweden. If the KLF's 1992 collab with Wynette sounds like a risky, gonzo, polarizing experiment, it was. Justified and Ancient is damn close to indescribable. So if you don't know it or remember it, pause this podcast right now and go put it on. But also, let me try to describe it. What you'll hear, or what you have heard, is a country rave mashup by way of South Africa. A trancy tribal curio about, yes, an ice cream van chugging along toward Moo Moo. But it's also a tune sprinkled with mysticism. Take, for example, the line, "New style, meanwhile, always on a mission while, fishing in the rivers of life," from the duo's guest rapper, Ricardo DeForce. Justified and Ancient is a perfect musical specimen of 1992. Cheesy, heady, random, all over the place, totally weird, totally fascinating. Here's how Turn Up the Strobe author Ian Shirley describes it.
It kind of reached into the history of America, of country music, which is your kind of, along with the blues and jazz, is like your folk music. So there was a kind of modern song with this sort of element of classic American folk music with it. She had singing a line like they're justified and they're ancient and they drive an ice cream van. I mean, that kind of like lyric is just insane, really, when you write it down. But when you actually put it in the context of a song, because she's singing about their myth. She is an American myth singing about this new band's own mythology. It's all that kind of linking of myths and kind of like old lore together. And it's so striking. That is the thing that makes it work.
And since this was the KLF, the music world's ruling stunt kings, the video for Justified and Ancient also had to represent these things. There is so much muchness in it, says Michelangelo Matos.
It's a big, splendiferous video. It's very, you know, it's very like opulent and very ridiculous. And so that was wonderful. I have great memories of that.
To execute their vision of Moomooland for the video, Drummond and Coddy had an ancient temple constructed at Pinewood Studios, the soundstage where some James Bond movies had been shot. During the video's production, Alien 3 was being filmed there. The pair then brought in dancers, Zulu singers, and actors posing as warriors to join Wynette, who was decked out in a snug, sparkly blue dress. Says Ian Shirley,
"You know, the funny thing about the KLF, everyone thought they were a live band. Because they thought that these videos were like Parliament Funkadelic. This was just a representation of the live show. And that's why they did it. It was to make it look like a massive performance. Because like I say, lots of house and dance bands, they were literally just a couple of guys behind synthesizers or computers and a girl singing. Whereas this, it looked like there was drummers. It looked like there was like bass guitarists. There were backing singers. There was sort of like nudity, there was clothes, there was, you know, Tammy Wynette and all this kind of amped up thing and these massive Marshall stacks, you know, all of the amplification. So this is great big pageantry. And it's just a shame that they actually never played live."
The whole thing was insane. But Tammy Wynette was game. I like to think of her as Tammy, why not? When NME interviewed Wynette about the collaboration, she was ecstatic, though she admitted she had no idea what the hell the song was about. "I know about ice cream vans, but I'd never heard of a 99 before," she said, referring to the line, "Make mine a 99. A 99 is basically a special ice cream cone with a chocolate flake bar shoved into the top of it. Side note, at one point, Drummond and Caudi considered executing a PR stunt in which they had a Jams ice cream van and they would hand out cones to people, but also give them a hit of ecstasy if they said, make mine a 99. That plan was abandoned. One outrageous stunt the KLF did instigate to promote the White Room was the Rights of Moo, an exclusive and extraordinary 1991 event in which Drummond and Caudi invited a select group of journalists to the Isle of Jura off the coast of Scotland for the summer solstice on June 21st. The invitation read, "The KLF require your presence. You'll be transported to the lost continent Moo. Bring your passports." As the group arrived by ferry to Jura that weekend, sure enough, Drummond was there to stamp the guest passports with the Jam's signature pyramid logo. What unfolded was an elaborate ritual filmed by Bill Butt, who had directed videos for Echo and the Bunnymen and the KLF's shelved White Room movie. Dressed in hooded robes and flaunting big tusks coming out of their foreheads, Drummond and Caudi escorted their visitors, who were also wearing robes they'd been provided, to a massive wicker man by the sea. There, a group of Japanese women donning diaphanous white gowns and blonde wigs took a personal item from each guest and placed it beneath the wicker man. Drummond recited some nonsense language. They set the wicker man on fire, and then, soon enough, corks were popped and drinks were poured. This was a media event, after all. The next day, the quartet of Japanese women hired to portray the Angels of Moo were filmed emerging from the sea, with Errol Nicholson popping up to sing Justified and Ancient. You know, to promote the actual music. At the end of the weekend, attendees were dropped off at the Liverpool Festival of Comedy, where during the intermission of a show at the Royal Court, some took to the stage to sing along to Justified and Ancient, and then enjoy ice cream served by Drummond and Caudi from their trademark ice cream van. Ian Shirley estimates that the Rights of Moo event cost about £70,000, or $80,000. And to think, nowadays all you need is for some kids to do a TikTok challenge to one of your songs. Still, the exposure the KLF got was significant, with journalists reporting on the experience and Butt's footage running on MTV. But the KLF's most career-defining and ultimately career-ending spectacles were still to come.
At one time it was stunts, which was all good for good copy. Then as it went on, it got a bit darker because it was almost like they wanted to sort of do something even more extreme. And that's where it kind of got crossed the line into this kind of strange sort of thing. What can we do that is going to shock people more?
Up next, after the break, I talk to Turn Up the Strobe author and KLF expert Ian Shirley about the band's notorious self-sabotaging performance at the 1992 Brit Awards and their astonishing decision to destroy their earnings and abandon the music industry altogether.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
My name is Johnny B. Good, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, Centratech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
I came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
The year was 1992, and after a string of hits and stunts, the KLF were massive and minted. Says KLF expert Ian Shirley,
it wasn't like they had a big record label. They got a deal through Rough Trade and distributed their music. So if they made a dollar a record, they kept a dollar a record. It wasn't that the dollar went to the record label, but then gave them 12 cents. They owned all of their products. They pressed up their product. So they were making tremendous amount of money. And don't forget, they weren't touring, so there wasn't that kind of overhead to pay for that. So they were making a tremendous amount of money. They were literally making, you know, millions of dollars.
Jimmy Cauty and Bill Drummond had loved doing press, but they were suddenly fielding tons of requests for interviews, TV appearances, and commercials, many of which they declined. Pressure also rose for them to tour, but as 30-something family men, they couldn't fathom life on the road. They even turned down an offer to perform as guests for Prince. At that point, the KLF single sales were through the roof. One chart declared them the third biggest selling singles act in the UK after Bryan Adams and Queen, who'd become popular again after singer Freddie Mercury's death. To commemorate their success, the Brit Awards, the UK equivalent of the American Grammys, invited the duo to perform at their ceremony at the Hammersmith Odeon in February 1992. Maybe they felt honored to be nominated for three awards: Best British Group, Best Single, and Best Album. But Drummond and Cauty agreed to actually perform live, which they never did. Of course, this was the KLF, so their rendition of 3 a.m. Eternal came with a twist. They would recruit UK hardcore group Extreme Noise Terror for a thrashing, barely recognizable heavy metal version of the song. You see, the pair had started to record their follow-up album to The White Room, titled The Black Room, with the band. But that project was shelved. Now, they deserted their original plan, which was to cut up a sheep corpse on stage and toss buckets of its blood and pieces of it onto the audience. But the KLF's Brits performance still involved some of their most mind-blowing hijinks yet. Drummond, dressed in a kilt and holding a crutch with a cigar pinched between his teeth, ended it by taking a machine gun and firing blanks into the crowd, a la Sid Vicious in the 1980 mockumentary The Great Rock and Roll Swindle. The insane set concluded with an announcement riffing on the final line of 3 a.m. Eternal. Ladies and gentlemen, the KLF have now left the building. In a more ominous, definitive statement, the duo's publicist, Scott Paring, declared, "The KLF have left the music business." Later that night, they deposited the dead sheep they planned to slice and dice at the show on the red carpeted steps of the Royal Lancaster Hotel, where the Brits after party was held. A note attached to the carcass read, "I died for you. Bon appetit." For many, the stunt crossed the threshold into gratuitous and grisly. It wasn't so much funny as it was bewildering, and to some, infuriating. Meanwhile, in a sort of fuck you to the Brits, and to the whole notion of prestige and accolades in general, Cauty took the pair's award for Best British Group that they won that night and buried it near Stonehenge. According to the 2021 documentary, Who Killed the KLF? After it was uncovered 2 months later and turned over to the police, the KLF went back and buried it deeper. Bill Drummond and Jimmy Cauty seemed to think they'd reached the pinnacle of success and that the only place to go from there was down. Why do that if they could go out on a high note and break up the party themselves? Says Ian Shirley,
they did everything. And it was that kind of all-encompassing madness that probably exhausted them. And then after a while, they realized that they'd done so much, they just couldn't top it. And the fact that people love what they were doing kind of like turn them off. That's the interesting thing. They wanted to kind of like destroy what they had, their own myth.
In the spring of 1992, shortly after their infamous Brit spectacle, the KLF stopped pressing albums and singles and set out to obliterate their entire catalog. A statement they released to the press and placed in ads and music papers read, "For the foreseeable future, there will be no further record releases from the Justified Ancients of Mumu, the Time Lords, the Jams, the KLF, and any other past, present, and future name attached to our activities. As of now, all our past releases are deleted. Answering machines and fax machines were shut off. Drummond and Caudi disappeared to Mexico." But the story doesn't end there. After engaging in another PR stunt and crashing the art world with the K Foundation Award, which in 1993 they gave to the artist who produced the worst body of work from the previous 12 months, the KLF made their biggest, most shocking artistic statement yet. They decided that they not only wanted to obliterate their music, but obliterate any trace of their profits from it. So, on August 23rd, 1994, they returned to the island of Jura in Scotland, struck a match, and set fire to their earnings, burning £1 million. They'd originally tried to get London's Tate Gallery to allow them to display the money nailed to the wall, but it, among other galleries, refused to showcase this quote-unquote art. So Drummond and Caudi took matters into their own hands, filming their hard-earned cash as it turned to embers, and presenting footage of their act of self-annihilation in various cities a year later. Audiences who saw it were flabbergasted. Many were enraged. Says Michelangelo Matos,
"I mean, it's really the most audacious thing you could do. I don't know how else to describe it. It's sort of breathtaking. I mean, in a way, it's callous. It's almost an act of, you know, class warfare."
I tracked down Ian Shirley, whose 2017 book Turn Up the Strobe chronicles a rise and self-induced fall of the KLF, to discuss that notorious Brits performance, their career literally going up in flames, and their decision to finally make their music available on streaming services in 2021.
Basically, right around the time that, Justified and Ancient was charting, they, you know, were invited to perform at the Brit Awards in early 1992. So tell me about their thought process going into the Brit Awards in 1992 and what they had planned, because I think this is maybe sort of the beginning of the unraveling of it all.
Yeah. Well, it already started. What happened was, normally you have to submit the song before performing, because obviously the actual show wants to know what you're going to play. And this was such a radically different version of their own song. They almost sort of told them that they couldn't play it. But they allowed the KLF to play it. But then this is where it got really dark, because there's all these talks of what they were going to do on stage. I mean, one time, Bill was going to cut up a sheep live on stage. So on the morning of the show, he goes and gets a sheep that he's pre-ordered. He was going to throw blood over the front of the audience, the front row of the audience. So he went up and got all this blood. He was going to, at one time, chop off one of his arms or something, I've read somewhere. It's just this absolute kind of using this moment to sort of have this amazingly visual kind of darkness. And what's so funny is that Extreme Noise Terror were all vegetarians. So the thought of actually Bill cutting up a sheep live on stage didn't really go down well with them. The thought of actually Bill throwing blood over on the front row of the audience didn't go well with them. And it's a classic thing that when they did perform, it all sort of went wrong, because Jimmy talked about having this great big guitar solo. He was a guitarist and wanted to have this massive big guitar solo. And they'd already decided that this would be their last ever performance. And of course, when he actually went to step forward to play his guitar, he pulled the lead out of the amplifier. And so by the time he got it back in, it was all over. And it was just, and also Bill did this classic thing where he came out in a trench coat with a cigar in his mouth, firing the blanks of a machine gun at the audience, which is all very much Sid Vicious, My Way thing. And of course, all the audience thought this was just part of the spectacle. You know, it was sort of transgressive, but it was just, oh, well done, that was exciting. Who's the next act? You know, the fact that they sent a bike courier to collect their award, again, it's just sort of like a modern kind of, you know, what someone would do today to get attention on social media. And of course, at that time, there was no social media. And that was their last performance. And that was, I think they went to the studio, they were going to carry on recording with Extreme Noise Terror. And then Jimmy said, look, that's it. I think we should stop. And they literally did stop at that point. That was the last time they actually appeared. And then obviously in the UK, they deleted their entire back catalogue. They deleted everything. But in America, I don't think they could delete the back catalogue because of the deal with Arista. So records over there sold for some time. But, you know, it's insane that an artist, you can imagine like Snoop Dogg or Madonna saying, well, I've stopped now performing, I'm not going to do anything more, no more streaming of my music, no more physical product. I mean, look at The Weeknd.
Right,
it's like
right.
The Weeknd saying, right, I become a born-again Christian, music is wrong. So suddenly, next month, you can't stream his music no more. You can't download his music no more. It's not on YouTube. You can't buy the physical product. It's that kind of level of success that they turned their back on. They just literally said, we will press no more records and no more CDs. And therefore, people would not be able to buy it anymore. It was an amazing sort of like, and they cut off their own income stream, you know, because really they would have actually made quite a lot of money over the years by actually their back catalogue selling. It would sell forever.
What was the catalyst, or what were the catalysts for them to call it quits?
I mean, this is the thing. I mean, when I wrote my book, I never got. I met Bill and Jimmy afterwards, but they kept very tight-lipped about their reasons. I mean, they had their reasons to stop him. Maybe they had enough. Maybe they got, you know, Bill and Jimmy thought that, how much more successful can we be? We've had worldwide hits, a worldwide top-selling album. You know, there's not much further you can do. That's why when they transitioned into the sort of the foundation where they actually, you know, did the prize, remember the Turner Prize, and then they gave their own awards and things like that. And they started doing stunts after that where a lot of the journalists would come along and say, oh, this looks great. But when they realized there was no music, there was no kind of new video, new song, that they lost interest in them. The interest waned because it was no longer these guys doing these merry pranks and there's some great music coming out. It was these guys doing these quite dark things which kind of like turned people off, and they lost kind of a lot of traction, which I think in some respects they enjoyed, and other times they thought, well, we want more attention. It was that's why the ultimate thing of burning £1 million, this insane kind of idea that all the money they made from music was tarnished, so therefore they had to burn it. And, you know, it's that kind of, what mental state were they in to sort of come up with that? And then what mental state were they actually follow through with it? And I know that from, you know, some of the wives weren't happy after that. You know that.
Why? Why? And exactly how do they go about doing it?
I think even today, I mean, they were one of the things, it's sad in some respects that they're remembered more for burning the money than they are for the music. It's something that they decided to do, and they had to live with it after that. And, you know, obviously, they had to pay tax on it or something, because it was, you know, they burnt, it's the money that they'd earned. You know, it wasn't unearned, you know, the money that, in fact, that, it's the fact that, I love the fact that they could get £1 million out of the bank. People were very upset because, you know, it's their money, they can do what they want with it. But people thought it was a very kind of strange thing to do, and the fact that, They didn't come out of it. People saying, "Oh, that's amazing." People thought, "You know, you're stupid. Why are you burning money?" And unfortunately, it became a coda. You know, they are the band that burned $1 million, or, you know, £1 million. And, you know, I think for a long time it was a shadow. Whatever Bill and Jimmy did, it sort of cut. I mean, Jimmy's done lots of art, and Bill's written lots of books and done lots of different things. But that's the one thing they're remembered by. I mean, rather than the music. The music's great.
I can see how some people would have thought it was in poor taste. Why not take that £1 million and donate it to some charities, you know, anything. I do wonder if they're plotting some sort of comeback or what is in the works, because it was a little strange, you know, the beginning of 2021 when, you know, some of their tracks were released on streaming and digitally the first time really since they took it all away, right? Did you know this was coming, or did you wake up surprised to discover that as well?
When they did after 20 years, they did the thing in Liverpool, which I went to, where they had like a sort of 3-day KLF extravaganza. I didn't know the music was coming. A lot of people didn't, but it's the sort of thing they would do. But I don't think they have any plans. I mean, Jimmy's been, you know, he's quite well known as an artist who's sort of, you know, in a sort of Banksy mode, really. And Bill's always done different things, from choirs to cooking to people. It's just sort of like part of their history. I know they've got a very rabid fan base, but I don't think they are looking to make new music, to do different things. I mean, I think the fact that they put the music out is sort of like the fact that, you know, they said, right, people have forgotten about it, so now we'll let people listen to it again. I mean, obviously, with streaming now, I mean, it'll have to make millions and millions of plays for them to make any money. They probably do make money from it. But I think it's very much part of their past. You know, they're not looking now to come back and restore the KLF, and nor should they. I mean, I think what they did now stood the test of time is music. It stood the test of time of visuals. It stood the test of time as sort of pranksters and kind of what they did as artists. And, you know, people can look back on it and enjoy it now. You can watch the video and not, you know, it's funny, I think they spent, you know, £250,000 on some of the songs and videos, but no one sort of like writes that off against them burning £1 million. I mean, Michael Jackson, I remember when he was doing History or something, he was like, I don't think he was like paying $1 million a track to work with people or something like that. You know, all the pop industry at one time, the amount of money that is spent on promo videos and things like that, and it just doesn't seem to matter. But if you go out and burn £1 million, it's kind of like people just get offended. It's interesting. I mean, it's resonated over time.
Yeah, it's interesting. That is a really fascinating take on it, because it almost makes me wonder if it was at least partly commentary on the fleeting nature of music and all the money that is dumped into these, you know, like you said, one single perhaps, right? And then let's say that single tanks.
Yeah.
Doesn't go anywhere. You know, barely scrapes the top 40 or not even. And but yet all this money was dumped into the promo, the video, you know, the remixes maybe, and that's just gone.
It's like with politics. You look at America, every time there's a Democratic or Republican campaign, a presidential campaign, billions of dollars are spent on advertising, on all of these things. And no one questions that it's a waste of money. No one questions it. Every day on the TV, I mean, I like American football. When it's on, I watch endless adverts for Pizza Hut, or these insurance companies. And they spend, obviously, millions of dollars to have it on during American football. No one questions that this money is spent just to reinforce the brand. It doesn't make a blind bit of difference. I mean, whether I buy a pizza or not, you know, all of these things whereby money is spent willy-nilly on things.
If you could sum up, you've touched on this a little bit already, but if you could sum up the legacy and impact of the KLF in music specifically, but then, you know, in pop culture as a whole, how would you sum up their impact and legacy?
I think the KLF have left sort of like musically as a tombstone. They've got the White Room album, you know, Justified and Ancient, 3 AM Eternal, What Time Is Love. You know, these are records and songs that will just go on forever, and people will discover them because they're great. It's great music, and you know, and they did the right thing, which is to make these amazing videos to promote the songs, so that when people look back, these young people who look on Spotify, they will think that the KLF were a big band that toured. They will think that they filled stadiums around the world, because they see these videos and think that's just a little replication of what they did live on stage. So what they've done, they've created this myth. And in some respects, what they did by stopping, they actually solidify what they did, because there's no kind of post-White Room albums that don't cut it. There's no kind of working with, you know, they did Tammy Wynette, and then they decided to work with someone like, Tony Christie, or they work with, you know, Kurt Cobain, which didn't come off. There's no kind of coda where the music just sort of like gets tired. They stopped making music right at the peak. And that was the kind of most savviest thing they did. They went out on top, and everything that happened afterwards, people will look back and see what they did. These three absolute monster singles, one bigger than the other in the music, in the visuals, and in the chart placings around the world. And they went out and said, thank you very much. Was it mic drop, as they said?
Yeah. A very big, very billowy, very smoky, fiery mic drop. Yeah.
Three decades later, the smoke has long cleared. But we're still left wondering if that money burning on the Isle of Jura was A, the most expensive and dramatic dissolution of a band ever, B, the product of the KLF guys teetering on the edge of sanity, C, the result of a lot of drugs and alcohol, or D, all of the above. Says Matos,
there's nothing on the record where they ever come clean about any other intention other than, let's see what it's like.
Regardless, on August 23rd, 2017, Drummond and Coddy barreled into Liverpool, England in their now old and battered ice cream van to prove that they still had a few treats to serve up to their diehard fans. Exactly 23 years after they scorched all that cash, Drummond and Coddy resurrected the Justified Ancients of Mumu, releasing a dystopian novel, 2023, a trilogy, and hosting a three-day happening called Welcome to the Dark Ages. The event, which some 400 quote-unquote volunteers attended, included various role-playing and a panel debate that posed the eternal question, why did the K Foundation burn $1 million? Conceptual artists and academics weighed in. When Drummond and Coddy themselves were asked the question, they simply replied, whatever. So after all that time had passed, still no answer. But guests were given torn out pages of the Jam's new novel for their time. The Jam's also announced their latest endeavor. No, not music, but a literal pyramid scheme. The People's Pyramid, a massive structure made of bricks from human ashes. Those who wished to contribute to the mummification could pay £99 to have their remains packaged into said bricks. The slogan for the process was, buy now, die later. The pyramid would be erected in Toxteth in Liverpool and updated each year on Toxteth Day of the Dead. After the announcement, a yellow-robed choir took to the stage of the event, held at the arts venue The Flory. They were joined by a blue-hooded figure soon revealed to be Jarvis Cocker, the lead singer of the UK Britpop band Pulp, who led them in a gospel version of Justified an Ancient. The happening culminated with the volunteers assembling in a field around a large pyramid onto which structures called coffins for life were stacked. Then, like the Wicker Man at the Rites of Mu, and like the KLF's millions in earnings, the whole thing was set on fire. Drummond and Coddy, sporting horns like they had at the Rites of Mu nearly 30 years before, stood in the night, watching from the sidelines. Depending on who you are, Welcome to the Dark Ages was either the comeback of the decade, a failed attempt to recapture the chaotic magic of a bygone era, or just a bunch of nonsense. But if you care to remember the KLF's music as much as their mischief, this wild and woolly story has a happy ending. It does for me anyway. On January 1st, 2021, I, along with many others, awoke to discover, with glee, that the KLF had finally put some of their songs on streaming services. Solid State Logic 1, a collection of 8 remastered singles, including 3am Eternal and Justified an Ancient, had dropped at midnight, while several of their official videos had been published for the first time on the duo's YouTube channel. Three more releases, including new versions of the albums Chill Out and The White Room, followed. The KLF had re-entered the building, their strange and boundary-pushing dance music re-emerging from its 30-year moratorium like an acid house Lazarus. I was reminded of their loony, impish brilliance and all the shit that went down in those 7 short years. Says Michelangelo Matos,
like, the fucking KLF were the coolest. Like, they fucking wore masks and they wore, like, hazmat suits and they were, like, anonymous and sarcastic and they pulled stunts. What was not to like? The records were great.
Who knows why Bill Drummond and Jimmy Cauty decided to break their musical silence and make a large chunk of their discography available again? Perhaps, like Ian Shirley suggests, they figured many had forgotten about it. So why not? In the KLF mythos, motives tend to remain mysteries. Logic can't be applied here. So then, maybe it's best to just hitch a ride in the ice cream van, follow the trail to Moo Moo Land, and lose yourself in the crazy. Where Were You in 92 was a production of iHeartRadio. The executive producers are Noel Brown and Jordan Runtog. The show was researched, written, and hosted by me, Jason Lanfier, with editing and sound design by Michael Alder June. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe and leave us a review. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, check out the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, The Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, The Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.